There's a time and a place for a fillet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
The Earth Transformed, an Untold History by Professor Peter Frankopan of Oxford University, a professor of global history. The mosquito empires of the period that we reach to in North America, as well as Africa, as well as Asia. The mosquito empires, the limits of malaria, a.k.a. yellow fever. I learned from the professor that in this period of exploitation of nature and mankind, in the 17th and 18th century, the limits of the people to survive in mosquito empires defined their ability to respond to the politics in Europe and also the opportunities in the New World. Professor, the malaria story is one that I did not ever think of as a limitation on the Europeans. Did they themselves see it that way?
Yes, they did. And the, in common parlance, West Africa was known as the white man's grave. So short were life expectancies when many Europeans tried to reach West Africa. And one of the challenges was around disease environments. Ironically, what happened in the case of transatlantic slavery was that many of the peoples who were being transported, of course, against their will in horrific conditions, bonded forever and their progeny too, were so desirable, particularly after the 1670s, 1680s, was because not all, but some populations in West Africa contain genetic mutations that give genetic resistance to malaria, or at least provide 90% resistance to malaria. And that mutation meant that their survivability in malarial areas, which has been passed down from generation to generation for several thousand years, made them extremely resilient in exposed malarial zones, both in West Africa, but also in the Americas once malaria became established in the late 17th century. And we can see the horrors of this because the prices of peoples who came from zones with high malarial resistance are higher than from others. So there was no idea, I think, about the science at the time amongst those buying and selling people's lives. But there was an understanding that for some reason, some types of people from some areas were more hardy and more able to cope with disease. And of course, I suppose, if you want to put it very crudely, they're racially superior in their ability to cope with infections that killed everybody else. So when we see mortality rates, for example, in North Carolina, when malaria becomes established, the numbers of those of white Europeans who don't reach their fifth birthday or don't reach 18, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the brutality of those who die. So transatlantic slavery is partly driven by that, but it's also driven by the fact that new crops that are brought back in the other direction across the Atlantic, like cassava, manioc, potatoes, allow for high levels of calorie provision in domestic populations that mean that there is labor forces that can be, in the first instance, can be sold because they're not no longer required in the same quantities. So there's a kind of constant reinsertion of the natural world, mosquito empires, crops, labor, soils, rainfall, to be able to work out how we think about this period. And the things I didn't know before I wrote the book were around, you know, the calculations about what was the best time of year to set sail from Africa with a shipload full. And it was always after the harvest had been collected in West Africa, also to make sure that their arrival points in the so-called New World would coincide with the ability to be able to feed those who'd survived across the journey. So the horrors, I think, of seeing a ecological and environmental and climatological context to the slave trade seems to be extremely important to understand it properly.
I'm struck by the assertion of the British, of the English sailors to dominate the slave trade. This is King Charles II Royal African Campaign. 50% in 1680 Africa trade, 90% of the Africa trade in the 1780s. So in that period between 1650 and 1750, the prosperity of Great Britain, well, England at the time, and then the uniting with Scotland, the prosperity was built on the African trade. Is that too general? Is that too much of a generality?
Yeah, I think one would qualify carefully. I mean, I think there's a whole cycle which all needs to be integrated together. I mean, in the first instance, some of those advances that were made in Britain at that time were because of education and universities, and that requires donors that make their money from somewhere. Many of those are making them very indirectly from the slave trade, but because they're industrialists that are building cities and real estate and et cetera, then they're making their fortunes in other ways. But fundamentally, the resource benefits that come back towards Europe from the silver, in the first instance, the silver of the Americas towards Spain in particular, but then towards the rest of Europe, then of the crops such as tobacco and cotton and sugar, all help fuel and come for the benefit of the people who are able to control that trade, the capitalist interests. So in that sense, one, I think, has to not put a simple answer on it, but there's no question that the foundation of European strength comes from the way in which the Americas are exploited, and to some extent also Africa, which is exploited for its labor, but also for minerals and resources too. And of course, Asia, where the high intensity of spice trades, silk trades, and this is all happening at a time where the East India Company is getting its hooks into Indian politics and Indian cash funds, means that one has to, I think, take this all as a whole. So, for example, with the Battle of Plassey at the end of the 1750s, Robert Clive is able to take control of the entire purse of Bengal, which he promptly takes back home and makes him possibly the richest man in the world, but certainly a billionaire many times over in today's terms. And one would link that, I think, to the ideas about racial superiority, around weapons training, around the ideas that Europeans should and could run the world better than anybody else. And I think that all feeds into a story that allows Europe to become the richest part of the world for several hundred years. But they're very new to the party. I mean, as I've written about in my book on the Silk Roads, Europe's rise has been extremely recent in the scheme of human history. No one would have bet on a little rock in the North Atlantic colonizing a quarter of the world. And the ability to do that, it requires some explanation. And I think the ecologies and the natural history plays an understated part of that in the way most people tell it.
Daniel Defoe, I only have a piece of the quote that you use, "No Africa trade, no continent." Was that an understanding in London at the time, or is he mocking the king?
No, it's an understatement. And he says, and if the continent goes, if transatlantic slavery goes, then Britain has no empire, no economy, and nothing to rest its hat on. And so I think there's a real awareness around the race against time to build a resilient imperial structure that makes sure it's protected. And that comes through investment in shipping, that comes through investment in new technologies, that comes through investment in knowledge. One of the things that the Royal Navy did so well was to train sailors to cope in difficult wind conditions that then helps build towards the First and the Second World Wars and the resilience that pays off many centuries later. So the creation of institutions is how Defoe wanted to protect these, and it's how the wealthy did it. And in Britain, we did it very well by making sure that the king wasn't allowed to make decisions. He wasn't allowed to send people to war without votes of parliament. And then on our cousins on the other side of the Atlantic and the colonies eventually took the view that the king shouldn't, and even parliament shouldn't be allowed to make those kinds of decisions when it came to the colonies, unless the colonies themselves had a vote. Although, again, as I write about in my book, it's more complicated than that, because in fact, some of the pressures and the desire of people living in the colonies of North America to create their own destiny, be master of their own destiny, was to do with their desire to be able to trade with hurricane-stricken places in the Caribbean and the southern part of the United States, where Americans like John Adams and Samuel Adams, eventually George Washington, felt that it was wrong to be stopped from trading with the French or the Spanish just because they were the enemies of England, where the Spanish and the French in distressed conditions would pay almost anything for goods coming from places like Philadelphia. And the idea that the Americans would be stopped from trading was one of the drivers towards the push towards independence.
Is it too early, this period, 1650 to 1750, to speak of deforestation, or is that already underway?
No, in the Americas, there's reforestation as it happens. The decline of the indigenous populations is so profound that we see levels of forest recovery that are quite substantial, so much so that some scholars have tried to think about whether there's a way in which we should think about the oxygen and carbon dioxide atmospheric changes in the 1600s to do with population death and reforestation. But in other parts of the world, there's heavy deforestation taking place at this time because of population rises and the rises of new empires and new cities. So it's always part of the holistic looking at the whole.
The book is The Earth Transformed, An Untold History. Professor Peter Frankopan is the author. We're next going to turn to the question of the great divergence, Europe versus Asia. I'm John Batchelor.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com. Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.